content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, from the science section. The title of this article is Drones Could Unite Ranchers and Conservationists. Flying robots could offer a non-lethal way to keep wolves away from cattle. And this was written by Kylie Mower. In the summer of 2022, several researchers with the USDA Wildlife Services held their breath as a drone pilot flew a large drone equipped with a camera toward a wolf standing in a pasture in southwestern Oregon. The team members watching from a distance expected the wolf to freeze or run away the minute the whirling rotors approached it, but to their disbelief, it did neither. Instead, the wolf wagged its tail, stretched out its front legs, lowered its head, and lifted its butt, a classic canine invitation to play, and precisely the opposite of what response researchers were hoping for. The project, led by Paul Wolf, the Southwest Oregon District Supervisor for Wildlife Services, was designed to find ways to use drones to scare wolves away from livestock, not give the animals a new toy. Later that night, the researchers tried again, this time outfitting the drone with a speaker that broadcast human voices. The wolf took off running. For the rest of the summer and fall, the field staff focused on using drones to discourage wolves from approaching cattle, in one case using a speaker-equipped drone to halt an ongoing attack. The three wolves fled, and the wounded steer survived. "We know for sure that we saved at least one animal doing this," says Dustin Ranglek, the Predator Ecology and Behavior Project Leader for Wildlife Service's National Wildlife Research Center, and a collaborator on the Oregon Project. An arm of the Department of Agriculture, Wildlife Services sometimes kills predators, such as wolves, in addition to implementing non-lethal livestock protection measures. Ranglack and the other researchers hope drones will help keep the peace between predators and livestock. Early detection is your best means of mitigating conflict before something negative occurs, says Jared Beaver, an assistant professor and wildlife management specialist at Montana State University. Before livestock get killed or before a wildlife species gets in trouble and has to be killed as well. Drones are already used for population surveys and even health assessments of hard-to-reach species, such as orcas. This can reduce the need for going up in small aircraft, one of the riskiest parts of a wildlife biologist's job. But Beaver would like to see the technology more widely used with predators. He says that drones would likely be most effective when used with existing methods of predator deterrence, such as range riders, people who accompany herds in order to deter wolves through their presence, guard dogs, and strings of flapping flags, called fladry. If equipped with thermal sensors, cameras, and artificial intelligence systems trained to recognize large predators, a drone could theoretically fly over a calving pasture at night and alert a sleeping rancher to possible trouble. Drones could also monitor areas where wolves or bears have been sighted, guiding range riders in their livestock monitoring efforts. Ranglack's analysis of the drone's effects on wolves in Oregon showed that they can reduce attacks. Prior to the 2022 drone flights, a wolf killed a cow in a study area almost every other night. But when drones were used to detect wolves near cattle and then scare them away with recorded voices, wolves killed only two animals over 85 nights. Though wolves are responsible for less than 1% of cattle deaths in the northern Rocky Mountain states, predator attacks can be costly and emotional for ranchers. Some federal and state wildlife protections permit landowners to kill wolves that are caught in the act, but but by heading off conflict before they start, drones could reduce the use of lethal control. Daniel Anderson, the founding director of the nonprofit for the Common Grounds Project, has been experimenting with drones on his family's ranch in Montana's Paradise Valley since 2017. Tucked inside Tom Miner Basin, the land is a haven for grizzlies and wolves. A licensed drone pilot, Anderson uses his drone to look out for his cows, surveying the landscape via his smartphone, which is connected to a handheld controller. If he detects a cow carcass, he can use the drone to check for nearby predators. "It's a little dangerous to walk into these settings," Anderson said. "Maybe we can use a drone to flush out animals, go in and do some recon to see if there's a bear on that carcass." After a neighbor was chased by a bear during a horseback ride, he asked Anderson to look for evidence of livestock predation by flying a drone into the densely wooded drainage where the incident occurred. Anderson's drone saw no sign of cow carcasses, but discovered that the sow had two cubs, a possible explanation for her defensive behavior. "That's obviously helpful," Anderson says. "That's a good use of the technology." He's also used a drone to monitor elk populations over the course of the year and to watch how different animals, deer, moose, sandhill cranes, respond to drones. Anecdotally, he's found that they're all sensitive to the disturbance, acting startled even when the drones are still hundreds of yards away. In his office at Montana State University, Beaver is modeling the kinds of simplified drones that he hopes to see become commercially available to landowners, a flying robot that can be operated without the help of computer scientists, software developers, or wildlife biologists. "I'm looking for those win-wins," Beaver says. From an ag standpoint, helping ranchers sleep better at night and a win from a wildlife conservation standpoint, too. He imagines a Roomba for ranch operations that could be activated with a smartphone. But drones still face barriers to widespread implementation. "We're all keenly aware of the limitations of this tool," Ranglack said. "For one thing, they're expensive. Drones mounted with thermal imaging capabilities necessary for nighttime monitoring with speakers such as the ones tested by Wildlife Services can cost $20,000 or more," he says. Anderson purchased his own drone, a simpler model, for about half that. Federal Aviation Administration regulations also require drone pilots to pass a certification test, and operators need to keep a line of sight on drones while they're in use. The Oregon researchers were working in flat, open pastures where wolves could be easily spotted, but trees and rugged topography can obscure the view and make flight more challenging. Then there's battery life. A drone's rechargeable batteries must be changed every half hour or so. In at least one instance in Oregon, a drone that detected a wolf ran low on power and had to return to base before it could scare off the animal. Although the ground crew was able to reach the site and stop the attack, the cow was injured so badly that it had to be euthanized. Anderson is also concerned that flying at high elevation, especially in the summer, can overheat drone batteries. "This isn't something any producer can just decide, hey, I'm going to do this, and pick up and do it," Ranglack said. "At least not yet. But it has some real promise under the right conditions." For his part, Anderson worries about the effects on wildlife. "I don't want to fly nearly as much now, just because of the impact," he says. Flying a drone, he surmises, is akin to introducing another predator, and it could drive off or stress birds and other animals he's not trying to keep away from his cattle. He also realizes that no single tool can fix everything. The number one killers of his cattle aren't wolves or bears, but noxious weeds such as Lake Larkspur, at least for now, Anderson can find those only by riding through pastures himself on the back of a horse. Our second article is The Crumblies are being scapegoated for America's gun failures. A society that has refused to regulate guns is now punishing parents for not doing so on their own at home. By Kimberly Whaley. A Michigan judge sentenced James and Jennifer Crumbly to 10 to 15 years in prison for failing to stop their son Ethan from murdering four students in 2021. The cases grabbed headlines because prosecutors aggressively charged the parents with the actual killings, as though they had pulled the trigger themselves, rather than pressing lesser offenses such as child neglect and failure to comply with gun safety laws. Separate juries had convicted them of manslaughter. The harsh sentences may presage more criminal liability across the country for shooters' family members and other caregivers, such as teachers and security guards, who theoretically could have stepped in to prevent the worst from happening. The people who possess real power to slow the scourge of gun violence in America, legislators, gun industry executives, and the U.S. Supreme Court, now have in their hands a new means of pointing blame and evading accountability. The tragedy occurred on November 30, 2021, when 15-year-old Ethan took a gun from his home and brought it to Oxford High School in his backpack. According to the evidence presented at trial, his parents had bought the gun and taken Ethan to a shooting range just days before the killings, ignoring multiple warning signs that he was experiencing severe psychiatric distress, including mental hallucinations and contemplating violence. When Ethan asked to see a doctor, his dad told him to suck it up. His mom laughed. After the school alerted the parents that their son was searching for ammunition online, she texted him, LOL, I'm not mad at you. You have to learn not to get caught. On the morning of the murders, a teacher found a drawing he had made depicting a person bleeding, along with the words, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me." The parents were called in for a meeting, but they declined to take him out of school. Shortly thereafter, Ethan removed the gun from his backpack in a bathroom and opened fire on his classmates. Prosecutors characterized the sentencing guideline range as if the Crumbly parents were each responsible for all four of the murders. At the end of the day, Jennifer's counsel argued, Mrs. Crumbly shouldn't be sentenced as if she could control that four people were murdered. Or if she had shot 100 people, she had a point. Oakland County Circuit Judge Cheryl Matthews emphasized at the sentencing that the evidence went beyond just bad parenting. The Crumblies ignored things that make a reasonable person feel the hair on the back of their neck stand up, the judge said. Opportunity knocked over and over again, louder and louder, and was ignored. No one answered. And these two people shouldn't have and didn't. Matthews went on to criticize James for unfettered access to gun or guns as well as ammunition in your home, and Jennifer having glorified the use and possession of these weapons. But here's the thing. Michigan's law at the time allowed for unlimited firearms access and storage in the home. The Crumblies acted in compliance with the law. Michigan's new secure gun storage law took effect only in February of this year, long after the murders. By then, the Crumblies had already served nearly 2 years in jail. Nobody contended that either of these two parents poses a further threat to society, and if they were hypothetically inclined to repeat their bad deeds, their son is in prison for life after pleading guilty to 4 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of terrorism causing death, and 19 other related charges. A law is now in place to dissuade them. The Crumblies are now being punished for failing to do what society writ large did not ask of them. For the most part, legislators across the country continue to sit on their hands, routinely peddling thoughts and prayers, rather than enacting gun control laws. Congress gets credit for the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, which bars civil lawsuits against firearm manufacturers, distributors, and dealers for harm caused by the criminal or unlawful misuse of a firearm, and says that the possibility of imposing liability on an entire industry for harm is solely caused by others is an abuse of the legal system. The Supreme Court, too, has done its part to perpetuate America's gun violence crisis. In 2022, a 6-3 majority struck down as unconstitutional a 111-year-old New York state law that required applicants seeking a concealed carry license to show a special need that distinguishes them from the general public. Absent a constitutional amendment, the ruling effectively bans states from enacting similar laws in the name of public safety, despite voter preference and historical practice. While Congress, state legislators, gun manufacturers, and the Supreme Court have done worse than nothing, parents are now headed to prison for not taking steps to impose common sense regulations, restrictions on their own at home. This regime has it exactly backwards. In a civil society, laws exist to protect us against our negligence and bad instincts. Putting someone's mother and father in jail as a warning sign to others is no substitute. Our third article, What I've Heard from Gaza, by Ahmed Farood Al-Khatib. For the first time in more than a month, I recently had the chance to talk with my 11-year-old niece, who is sheltering with my surviving family members in the southern Gazan city of Rafah. She described her daily routine, which consists of little more than playing boring games on her mom's cell phone, which has no cell reception or internet access, and eating whatever food is sent through the Rafah crossing. It's also salty from the cans, or really dry, she told me. A few days before, they had bought a frozen chicken for about $20, the first protein in months that hadn't come out of a can. But at least Dad can afford aid food, which is sold to people instead of being for free. She sounded painfully adult, fully aware of the inequities of aid distribution among desperate Gazans. Hundreds of thousands of Gazans are struggling each day to secure the calories that they need to stay alive. Greedy merchants, corrupt Hamas officials, and criminal enterprises regularly seize aid meant to be distributed for free and resell it at highly inflated prices. And the food that makes it through, saturated with sodium and other preservatives to keep it shelf stable, is seldom palatable. The horrendous humanitarian situation facing the Gaza Strip civilian population has been worsened by a string of deadly incidents. The deaths of desperate civilians awaiting the arrival of an aid convoy in northern Gaza, the devastating Israel Defense Forces killing of 7 World Central Kitchen staff in central Gaza, and strikes on aid sites, including an UNRWA distribution center in southern Gaza. The IDF's combat operations and its negligent and reckless behavior, the breakdown of law and order, leading to looting, theft, and gang activity, and the problems that aid agencies face with their logistics and their access to parts of Gaza are combining to worsen matters. When the war started and Israel stopped commercial and humanitarian deliveries to Gaza through the port of Ashdod and the Kerem Shalom crossing, the international community had to quickly figure out how to deliver aid through the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt, which was formerly used for passenger transit and not the transportation of bulky goods. The effort suffered from complicated procedural and logistical challenges as organizations struggled to comply with Israel's elaborate inspection regime. Israeli authorities insist that the bottlenecks are a result of failures by the United Nations and the NGOs, While critics accuse Israel of using food as a tool to pressure Gaza's population and Hamas, either way, the result is that large segments of the population in the besieged strip struggle daily to sustain themselves. The crisis is particularly acute in northern Gaza, which faces famine-like conditions. A newly constructed IDF roadway bisects the strip, restricting access to the north and making it difficult to deliver aid that comes in from Rafah in the south. Food airdrops, a measure I have long advocated for, have attempted to put essential items directly into the hands of civilians, bypassing distribution by NGOs and others, and reducing interference by Hamas and criminal gangs. World Central Kitchen established a small jetty that was used to open a maritime corridor for delivering food from Cyprus. Additionally, the UN's World Food Program sent several trucks into northern Gaza in coordination with the Israeli military and used locals to provide security and assist with distribution. Unfortunately for Gazans, Hamas continues to display ruthless disregard for its own people's well-being. The Islamist terror group appears solely focused on its operational and tactical survival, regardless of the strategic consequences of its actions or the damage it inflicts on the Palestinian cause. Until Gaza can find a viable alternative to Hamas's rule, it will struggle to distribute humanitarian aid, reestablish public safety, and repair its battered infrastructure. The arrogant intransigence of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has refused to accept pragmatic proposals such as the reintroduction of a reformed and improved Palestinian Authority, presents a significant obstacle. Furthermore, despite a ferocious military campaign that has destroyed most of Gaza, which Hamas's health ministry estimates has killed more than 33,000 people, Hamas has demonstrated an uncanny resilience and ability to persevere. On a recent trip to the Middle East, I met people who had left Gaza Strip and others whose families remain there. They told me about the hardships they had experienced since October 7th in horrifying detail. At the beginning of the war, IDF ordered civilians to evacuate northern Gaza. Hamas, though, wanted to keep the population in place to serve as human shields and to complicate the Israeli military's operations. Some Hamas fighters took this to an extreme, killing several civilians on the Al-Rashid coastal highway using small arms and machine guns. Roadside bombs along the Salah al-Din highway were meant to scare people off so that others would stop fleeing south, but ended up hitting a convoy of vehicles carrying civilians, killing more than 70 people. Disturbingly, members of Hamas and sympathetic clerics kept citing an Islamic warfighting doctrine from Surat al-Anfal in the Quran, Ayah 15 and 16, that prohibits turning one's back to the enemy when facing them on the battlefield. One man told me that his brother was pressured by his Hamas neighbors to stay in Gaza with his family and children. They referenced these Quranic verses over and over and threatened severe consequences now and on Judgment Day if he were to flee the incoming IDF invasion. I hesitate to share this account because I don't want it to obscure the fact that the IDF has also killed fleeing civilians. My brother and his family were fired at by IDF tanks in the Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City as they were fleeing southward. Some of Israel's supporters have been unwilling to acknowledge that IDF field troops and commanders have committed horrendous acts against civilians, whether due to indifference, recklessness, or vengefulness. However, I am most horrified that if Israel launches an incursion into Rafah, Hamas will again use force and intimidation to prevent civilians from fleeing. During my trip to the Middle East, I was discouraged to witness the way that many Palestinians and their supporters in the Arab world obtain information about the war in Gaza. A sizable segment of the population gets its news through social media platforms, all rife with misinformation, disinformation, inaccuracies, conjecture, rumors, and propaganda. When I tried to convince people that I met that Hamas had committed atrocities on October 7th, they responded with open disbelief. Almost everyone denied it, claiming that these were false allegations or that the Israelis had killed their own people. I offered to show them videos of the atrocities, including ones that I had privately obtained. Approximately half of those I spoke with eventually conceded that Hamas had, in fact, committed terrible atrocities against Israeli citizens, something that is unethical and inconsistent with the Muslim faith and warfare rules. The other half, however, seemed shocked and confused, unable to make sense of what I was telling them, which is entirely at odds with their understanding of the war. Unfortunately, a large number of Palestinians and their allies in the Middle East and the diaspora do not regularly read news stories or analyses about the conflict from mainstream outlets. In the Middle East, Al Jazeera Arabic continues to be a substantial source of information, and it spreads Hamas's resistance narrative and its propaganda. People who form their views from social media will have a skewed understanding of October 7th and the war. They're also unlikely to understand the history of the region, of Hamas, of the peace process, and of Palestinian leadership's failures and mistakes. The war in Gaza has worsened already deep fissures between the Palestinians and the Israelis and their respective allies. We need to stop the war, free all the Israeli hostages, address the humanitarian crisis, and initiate political transformation in Gaza to prevent Hamas from remaining in power. That will require both sides to recognize their mutual humanity and commit to building a shared future. For the Palestinians, this will require abandoning unrealistic goals, violent resistance, and incendiary rhetoric, all of which have failed them for 75 years. For the Israelis, it will require acknowledging that they cannot achieve lasting safety and security through military force, occupation, settlement expansion, separation walls, or denial of the historic injustices inflicted upon the Palestinian people. The people of Gaza are desperately ready for a change and eager to end the domination of both Israel and Hamas over their lives. Ahmad Froud Al-Khatib, the author, is a U.S. citizen from Gaza and is a Middle East political analyst who writes extensively on Gaza's political and strategic affairs. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.